Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money, major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Oh,
young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he can fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Afraid of change? You can't do anything about it. Change is inevitable. Growth is the great fundamental principle, the function of our lives. The seed in the ground will rot if it does not sprout and grow. And so will our minds and souls and bodies. Without conscious action and striving, our Creator answers most prayers in the terms of ideas for action. He doesn't give us something for nothing. He expects us to use what He gives us in active exercise of a freedom which He permits our minds and souls to exercise in reactions to the life patterns of ups and downs, strange events, curious, unforeseen happenings. Human consistencies, all can be changed according to the way our mind evolves, adapts, and grows. Nothing in this world is so inevitable, nor hardly so obvious. The fact is, everything does change. So often we'd like things to remain the same. It'd be so comfortable, nice. We get used to things. We adapt ourselves to a certain pattern. And then suddenly, without any warning, it changes. What are you going to do about it? Well, the first step in gaining a happier and more satisfying state of mind is recognition of the significance of this fact. Everything changes. Everything in life is changing as you and I are changing. And we must do more than this to take proper advantage of the ceaseless change inevitable in our lives. We must consciously react to direct actions that change in the paths of improvement, in the growth of our mind and soul. Change alone is inevitable and constant. But change alone is not growth. It is not progress. We have to do the progress ourselves. We have to convert. We have to adapt. Growth is a cornerstone, the primary marvel of our earthly lives. Our Creator has provided for physical growth in a pattern in which He has given us only limited powers to alter. From babyhood, we go to childhood. From childhood to adolescence. From adolescence to adulthood. And so the story grows. Physical growth. But the way we adapt ourselves to prepare ourselves for those unusual situations, the ones which we can call pleasant or unpleasant, that depends on the way we grow in our minds, the way we grow in the power of adaptation. For friends, life is a constant adaptation. Every phase of life presents a spectacle of change. And as a consequence, the spectacle of retrogression, a standstill status or progress of growth. In each case of progress or growth, there is a constant overcoming, a vanquishment of the obstacles met in the Creator's pattern of constant change. See, that's all important. All about us, we see growth or deterioration taking place in grass, in flowers, in vegetables, in pets, in our children, in our own body. But the thing that's important is the way we adapt ourselves to this change. That's all important. In our affairs, all too often, we select for cultivation the very things we don't want. Courses that lead to mistakes and trouble, sorrow and pain. Then we carefully endow these selections with the full energy of our thoughts and words. We water them with tears and self-pity. Give them the concentration of undivided attention. And then we have a way of wondering why, indeed of all our efforts, we grow in a crop of trouble and discord. Let me tell you, it is not necessary. Let us deliberately refuse to turn our thoughts to those weeds we do not want. We must discipline our minds to concentrate on the good, on positive thoughts, the sunshine and water and soil that produce good in our lives. On the thought energy, the emotional powers we concentrate on our affairs to convert inevitable change into growth. In other words, our job every single day, and this day too, is to watch where we're going, what we're doing. If we want love and happiness, be sure it's to love and happiness that you devote your attention, not to discord and bitterness and resentment. If you want success in some field, give full recognition. Yes, give full recognition to success. And it's yours already. Think positive thoughts. Fix the life-giving force of your attentions and assurance and faith on the good you already have. Look for it in every circumstance. Now make no mistake about it. Change is inevitable. You can't halt the process of change any more than you can keep your child a baby. In the words of Dr. Arthur H. Compton, everywhere the conditions of life are changing rapidly, and these changes are all in the direction of greater interdependence. That is, making better cooperation of paramount importance. The point is that in this process of change, we go forward or we go backward. We bow to circumstances or we rise above circumstances. Of course, we cannot be expected to see beyond the point of our understanding any more than we can see beyond the horizon limit of our eyes. But the point is, we can master the thoughts we permit to remain in our minds. We can choose our thoughts according to God's laws. We know we get out of life exactly what we put into it. Nothing more, nothing less. We know if we sow love, we shall reap love. We sow hate, we reap hate. We have the power to concentrate on whatever kind of thoughts we choose. We know that if we endeavor to have an understanding heart, we shall find elsewhere an understanding heart. We know if we pardon, we shall be pardoned. We know if we give, we shall receive. Look at your own picture, 5, 10, or 20 years ago. See what a change has been made on the outside, in the outside person. You will scarcely know yourself. Well, that's the growth of the body. But God has given you the mastery of your mind. Your soul can keep pace with the growth of the body. Just as the less perceptible growth of the trunk of the tree matches the more visible enlargement of its limbs. Look back at what you were thinking 5, 10, or 20 years ago, at the obstacles which seemed insurmountable then, at the joys and sorrows of yesterday. And just as it's hard to believe, those old photographs are you. Yes, we really looked as we did, not as we see ourselves in the mirror today. So it is equally difficult to imagine the progress, the maturity, that our soul has accomplished and made in the course of these years. In other words, we do not change without more than we change within. This is all important to know. There is no limit to the transformation which can take place in your mind. When we dig a little deeper in our search for answers to life's questions, when we wisely read between the lines, we find that God puts his blessings upon our efforts and draws us close, imparts to us his divine wisdom. We find, first of all, that our soul, our mind, gains maturity as we react in a positive manner to the pattern of life, no matter how unpleasant or unexpected. A pattern which we may not be able to change, except in our minds. But remember, that's all important in our mind, because what actually counts is what we think, the way we feel about something. The growth of the soul, therefore, depends upon our free reaction to the problems with which we are faced. Our life is part of a divine plan, carefully prepared in every detail. Each moment of that plan offers a marvelous opportunity for our adaptation, for the growth of our soul and of our mind. The whole picture of our lives is so much brighter than the small pieces that hold and which our minds are prone to dwell on at length. Isolated from the background of all this, the whole, some parts, may look awfully black. But let me tell you, our Creator, in time, ultimately moves in on our subconscious mind and plays a pleasant trick on all of us. The unpleasant experiences of the past are relegated to the past. When we realize the power of our mind, the real secret escapes us. As long as we fail to exercise that freedom of choice, all important, endowed to us by our Creator. This mystery of growth functions in time of crises more than ever before. We say, why does this happen to me? How could this happen to me? I don't deserve this. Suppose we say, this is an opportunity, a challenge to react and gain greater maturity. Life with its steady, compelling urge to grow means that any door may open to us at any moment. Life makes us beneficiary of the physical experiences that the ages have bequeathed to us, of the signs and inventions of genius, of the mental and physical work of our forefathers that set us free to seek the larger spiritual things of life. Friends, let us profit by these examples of the past, by physical knowledge, to prepare ourselves better for the experiences of life. Yes, we can encounter experiences of all kinds along life's highway, good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant. We can prepare ourselves for many trials simply through the richness of knowledge of those who lived before us. But along that same highway, Each of us is certain to meet some experiences so different from those for which we are prepared and so unexpected. But the point is, are they going to catch us unprepared and unawares? Each of us on life's journey must face a great many such surprising and disconcerting experiences that happen every day, any minute, and take us unprepared and aware. The knowledge that somehow or other we have inside of us the strength, the power, and mastery of our mind to control every situation, to react, and so to change in our mind our feelings about any problem and situation is all important. What a wonderful privilege is ours to be a human being, to know that we endow with the mastery of our mind, that we can control through our reactions whatever is our fate. No, we may not control circumstances or situations, but we can control our life because we control that which we feel about life. What a wonderful challenge it is. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the United States.
Give everybody a chance to dig what they really want to. I know just the other day I was telling my baby about the things that I dig. I was saying,
for reparations is in the early stages, but those behind it say it's long overdue, and it begins with acknowledging the damage.
The people who have a problem with reparations, then let's have a conversation. Let me find out what your problem is, and I can guarantee you, as we leave that conversation, you'll have a different thought about reparations, and I'll guarantee you, if I'll probably have a different thought about you, too.
Attorney Todd Perkins has joined the Michigan Democratic Party Black Caucus, a grassroots organization, in their push for reparations for black Detroiters. By definition, reparations is the making of amends for a wrong by paying money or somehow helping those who have been wronged.
I know one thing that is not a handout. You know, it is a hand up. It is something that black Detroit is owed. And I think, again, we're going to start to study and research what are other cities doing, what fits best in Detroit. But I think it's about creating economic upward mobility for Detroiters, generational wealth, home ownership, things that, you know, historically we've been left out of.
This week, Detroit City Council President Pro Tem Mary Sheffield put forth a reparations resolution. She says acknowledges that African Americans have been systematically oppressed and harmed through slavery, segregation, policing, incarceration, and voter suppression.
You know, there's a lot of needs, a lot of issues. There was a lot of discriminatory policies that left out so many Detroiters, right, as it relates to creating generational wealth for their families. And so we want to explore, we want to research, we want to study the issue of reparations.
And any reparations would not necessarily be in the form of a monthly payment to qualifying black Detroiters, but Perkins says the money could come from Detroit's marijuana tax.
One, they're new funds. You know, I have a look upon it because I know so many African Americans who went to prison because of involvement in marijuana and in a behavior and an activity that today is now legal.
You know, majority white, city government that is majority white, taking seriously these claims about intergenerational inequalities.
The Chicago suburb of Evanston is the first in the country to create a reparations program for its black residents in the form of a $25,000 home improvement credit for those who suffered from discriminatory housing policies.
Corralling blacks into a segregated neighborhood and then collaborating with banks and developers and real estate agents to devalue the property in those neighborhoods.
Todd Perkins has presented the city with almost 4,000 signatures to get a proposal on the ballot that would change the charter to allow a group of Detroiters to decide on the appropriation of money.
If this is a democracy, then allow democracy to take place and let the people speak about at least how they spend their money.
And this Friday, those behind this push for reparations will hold a press conference to begin engaging the community to get their input. In Detroit, Kimberly Craig, 7 Action News.
All right, thank you so much, Kim, as always.
Hey, guys, in this case, marijuana, but first it has to get on the ballot. The group behind it has been collecting signatures for the past 3 or 4 weeks. The deadline is tomorrow.
How many signatures are needed to get this on the ballot?
It's a little bit more than 3,600 signatures.
And where are we at now?
We're close to 4,000.
And come November, Detroiters may vote on whether the city provides reparations to its African American residents.
It's the biggest blackest city, but you still see an economic divide, a gap that is significant, and it has not been quelled.
Attorney Todd Perkins is part of a grassroots effort that would allow Detroit voters to change the city's charter, giving the people the right to pass legislation to earmark city funds. He says it would be a game changer for Detroit, in which 30% of its residents live below the poverty line.
It's also a very symbolic thing. There's an acknowledgement. Everybody can acknowledge slavery is wrong. And everybody could say, I'm sorry, but words mean action.
Ideally, where would this money come from?
Well, ideally, the money would come from marijuana revenue. You know, as much as people may have been against recreational marijuana in the city of Detroit, there's now going to be revenue that's generated from that. There's going to be revenue that's returned to the city from the state, and we would like to capture that money. It right now, it hasn't been allocated.
There's been a big push for reparations in Detroit. The city's Charter Commission proposal calls for a task force on the issue. Council President Pro Tem Mary Sheffield is tweaking a resolution on reparations that will come to a vote on Tuesday. Perkins says if the petition drive is successful and the issue ends up on the ballot, it could draw more Detroiters to the polls in November when they vote to keep or replace Mayor Mike Duggan and city council members.
I think it'll increase voter turnout. It'll increase, it may even increase a divide. But even with a divide, look what we had. We had one of the greatest turnouts last November because of the divide that we saw in this country. And that's a good thing.
All right, the city clerk's office
will have to review those signatures to make sure that enough of them are valid for this effort to be on the ballot. In the meantime, Council President Pro Tem Mary Sheffield, she plans on holding a press conference on Friday on her resolution for reparations here in the city. You, Taryn?
Randy, I know it may be early. Do we have any idea how many Detroiters are behind these efforts?
Well, generally speaking, many of them are. The state's Democratic Party's Black Caucus commissioned a survey, a poll, of 400 Detroiters talking about reparations and found that about 65% of them either support or lean towards supporting reparations in some form or fashion.
Sounds like an issue for Let It Rip. All right, Randy, thank you.
Hey, guys, in this case, marijuana, but first it has to get on the ballot.
One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
When I got over here, some of the doors we couldn't even open.
I've come to school to learn. I am responsible for myself.
And there was trash from bottom to top. The stench was horrifying.
I was listening away all sorts of all times.
It was shameful what was going on. These kids have the potential of everyone else. They've been invisible for a long time here in Detroit.
Detroit schools are a failure. There's no way to argue against that. 90% of students in Detroit public schools, eighth graders, are not proficient in math or reading. It's hard to understate how important that is and how critical that is for the livelihood of the city.
The culture of corruption in the Detroit public school system.
Teachers have refused an 8% pay cut.
My two-year-old deserves a Detroit that has quality public education.
With the fiscal problems never ending coming out of the Detroit public school system, fraud or embezzlement of any activity is unacceptable.
Detroit public schools deserve a long-term solution, not just a quick fix.
When the state decided to take over the district through emergency management, it was also around the time when charters came in completely unregulated. So you have economic instability coupled with educational insecurity. Can you imagine that happening in suburban America? Go to your average suburb where you have a what's considered a decent school district, and the government comes in and says, the people you elected are now removed, and we are going to pick your leader. No, it only would happen in Detroit because of politics and race. Growing up in Metro Detroit, I've always stayed up to date with what was happening in the city and in the district, and when the board was elected for the first time in over a decade, the search firm called me and said, we know you have roots in Detroit. Would you be interested? And I said, I would, on the condition that the board is serious about reform. So walked into a district that in many people considered the worst performing large urban school district in the country. There was an understanding that this was a window to try to rebuild the district the right way.
If you had a great weekend, put your right hand.
Principal Scott represents someone who focuses on the problem in front of her. I'm the principal of this building. How do I create the greatest amount of energy and focus on children, regardless of the chaos outside of the school?
We had to sift through piles and piles and piles of debris. It was really a cleaning process, and was funded by the people that worked in this building.
When you're educating children, the environment is important. You don't want them learning in filth. So we started cleaning up the school.
I'm here. My kids are here with me. Sometimes my husband's helping me bring things up so that we can clean up and clear out, pulling up the carpet, painting the walls, doing whatever we can to make it presentable.
I can remember hiring some teenage boys to come in. I think it was about five of them just to clean up my room. Okay, it was just that much trash.
These kids, they were the invisibles, and it was so sad to see that there was just lack of care, lack of concern, and I knew that we had to make a difference. This school needed to be cleaned, and it needed to be painted, and it needed to be filled with love. And if I came in here and didn't do those things, then I'm just as guilty as those who were before me.
All these were painted.
different colors, whatever color the teacher wanted.
We should have a district where principals don't have to figure it out. We need $500 million to bring all of our schools to 2020 standards. It's unfortunate because we should have national resources being poured in to revamp our facilities, to lower class size, but right now there's just a level of indifference.
We are a full Title I program, which means makeup of our school is lots and lots of families that are below the poverty level and that have a great need. It does not mean that people don't love their children. It doesn't mean that they don't care. They are facing some challenges that most of us don't face. And so what we tried to do is we tried to make sure that they had the same opportunity that other families had. So we immediately decided to have a uniform.
If you have on your full uniform, including your tie, now is your time to shine.
It's financially feasible to have a uniform. We immediately put in a washer and a dryer. We immediately got the showers fixed because sometimes people don't come to school because they haven't had a chance to wash their clothes and they're embarrassed.
Sometimes we will go in our own pockets and either purchase detergent. I've had uniforms in my closet. Sometimes if they don't make it to school on time or they haven't eaten breakfast, breakfast bars, don't feel well. Did you eat breakfast this morning? No. Go eat this real quick. Give them a bottle of water, come right back in, they're set.
When these children come to our school, it is our job to make them feel safe, to make them feel loved, and to portray to them the real importance of education because education can transform lives. I truly believe that. That is what I give my children when I teach them.
We try and not be a part of the problem, but be a part of the solution. And we don't mind either going in our own pockets or asking others in the community, what can we do for the young people, because that's our main objective and goal.
In 21 schools, there was at least one fixture that had elevated lead levels.
Excited about the fact we have new curriculum, excited about the fact that we have art and music back in every school, that we've reduced teacher vacancies, and then you have to deal with lead in water.
The reality is I'm a Detroit Public School graduate, and I have a 10-year-old, a fifth grader in Detroit Public Schools, and I'm very concerned about the quality of the water.
We identified the challenge. We transparently engaged the community about it. We implemented water coolers quickly. It's a good example of really what Detroiters do. I mean, it's about perseverance. It's about struggling through challenges that you don't always bring about yourself.
I'm happy that the district said, you know, the best move to take is to turn it all off. But, you know, we could be living with this for the next, you know, calendar year, maybe 2, 3, or 4 years. We just built a billion-dollar arena in a section of the city that used to be one of the poorest, and we subsidized it by giving a billionaire family tax dollars. In addition to that, capturing some money that would have gone to the Detroit Public Schools. It doesn't help a child in Northeast Detroit or in Northwest Detroit to know that there's another taxpayer-funded arena in downtown. These are the failed policies, in my view, that keep the city from having the true renaissance that many of us want it to have.
The education system has to be fixed for anyone living in the city, particularly impoverished people in the city, to even stand a chance at getting out of that poverty.
Before they even step foot in our schools, our children are already behind based on poverty. And we don't talk enough in this country about what are the problems that poverty creates, the trauma of poverty, defined through crime, defined through neglect, defined often through drug use. So we talk about literacy, math, science, social studies. Hard to get there when you're dealing with these other factors. And so those are all challenges that our children face at greater scale number because of the concentration of poverty in Detroit. But in third grade, 10% of our children are reading at grade level based on the state assessment. So that already shows you that if students are starting in kindergarten at 1%, you can see the improvement made. Obviously not what we want, not what children deserve, and not what the city deserves, but it does show you that work is happening.
If you're not educated, if you can't read, if you can't add, if you can't do some of the foundational things that you need for life, then what are you going to do? If we don't get this thing right, We're going to die on the vine.
NBC News fans, thanks for checking out our YouTube channel. Subscribe by clicking on that button down here and click on any of the videos over here to watch the latest interviews, show highlights, and digital exclusives. Thanks for watching.
Today's podcast is titled, Should Berry Gordy and Smokey Robinson Get Detroit Reparations? That's the question today. That's the title of the show today. We can also call it, Should Detroit, Citizens of Detroit, the Black Citizens of Detroit, African-American Citizens of Detroit, should they receive reparations? I'm going to play another clip or two and see what you guys have to say. And one of the reasons why I put those two names in the headline, Berry Gordy and Smokey Robinson, here are two Detroiters. Nobody's going to give them anything. Berry Gordy used to work, he was a factory worker at one time in Detroit trying to make ends meet. I think Smokey Robinson at one time probably lived in the projects. Most of the original Supremes did. Brewster Projects in Detroit? Yeah. Diana Ross, Smokey Robinson, Berry Gordy, the late Aretha Franklin, who had like an estate of worth $80 million when she passed away. The Four Tops, the Temptations, the Jackson Five, you can break that down to Jermaine, who went solo, Michael Jackson, who left behind a sizable estate, which is still supporting his children. He's been gone for some time now. Shorty Long, Tammy Terrell, God knows how many incarnations of the Temptations, the Four Tops, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, the Barge family, including Chico DeBarge, Bunny DeBarge, Bobby DeBarge. Countless artists, many of whom became millionaires, many still who are millionaires, those who weren't millionaires, you know, they're not doing bad. Not all, well, you know, Motown Records recording artists, you know, struck it big. Stevie Wonder. So, and we're talking about Detroiters now. And Motown still exists, although Berry Gordy sold the company, but he's not living at a shelter. Neither is Smokey Robinson. So, if this group of black folk can get together, let's go outside of Motown. Dave Bing, former Detroit Piston player, after he retired from the NBA, and he was in the NBA when they weren't making millions of dollars. He was in there, they weren't making that kind of money. They were probably making maybe $17,000, $20,000 a year. And many of them had to get, you know, off-season jobs. Dave Bing became a millionaire by starting his own business in Detroit, and later on Dave Bing became the mayor of Detroit. The late Mel Farr, when he was living, he probably sold more cars, at least used cars, in the entire Detroit metro area. He was one of the top black entrepreneurs in the United States, also Detroit, Michigan. So if these black folk, and I've named several of them so far just off the top of my head, if they made it big without getting reparations and handouts. Why should any black person, period, in Detroit get reparations today? We just played a clip of the Detroit school system, and black folks have had control of that city for God knows. Coleman Young alone was mayor for 20 years. At the same time, Detroit had a majority of black city council members, the majority of black folk running the criminal justice system. What, Kim Worthy? I believe she's still here, prosecutor up there. If not, she was a prosecutor up there for a long time. So you got your DA office headed by a black woman. The majority of your judges in Detroit, black. You know, Coleman Young, 20 years. Kwame Kilpatrick, although he got in trouble, but he was a black mayor. I think they've probably only had one white mayor. Dave Bing, another black mayor. So with all these success stories on the political level, on the entrepreneurial level, you can today in 2021, July 2021, you can find, there's no shortages of houses that you can buy in Detroit for $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000. There are plenty of them. So why should black folk even entertain the thought of getting reparations in Detroit?
Tonight we are taking action for some neighbors who are living a nightmare after squatters moved in on their block.
They've been cited, even caught stealing electricity, but somehow they're still there.
And that has our Ronnie Dahl paying them a visit. She joins us live from Detroit's East Side with more squatter drama. Ronnie.
And there is a lot of drama going on out here. Now, this is why I'm here. Take a look at the block. This is a place where the yards are tidy, the houses are nice, the kids are playing, families are being raised here. Yet some of these neighbors that have lived here for generations tell me they're being forced to live in fear after some thugs decided they wanted to live on the block. And even with the new squatter laws, getting them kicked out isn't so easy.
Hi. How are you?
Friday afternoon, I stopped by the house on East Burn Street, introduced myself to the squatters. That's me.
Oh, okay.
That's me. I'm Ronnie.
Are the camera on?
Yeah.
Are we on the news right now?
Yeah, you sure are, honey. No. News crew or not, they don't seem to care. So we're trying to figure out what you guys are doing in this house. Did you hijack it?
Hijack it? No, ain't nobody hijacked our house.
We go back and forth.
Look, ain't nobody living here. We're just here for the moment.
You're just here for the moment. How long's that moment?
Okay.
Detroit police tell me Tanya Houston and her crew have been living here close to a year. The elderly owner moved out. The house is in transition, making it an easy target. Tanya was cited for squatting and for stealing electricity several times. I'm told she showed cops a lease, but it was fake. When I asked to see it, I got a performance.
She ain't the landlord. Why she want to see the lease?
Out of concern for the neighbor's safety, we didn't talk to them on camera. They have to live here when we leave, and these aren't nice guys.
We live in this black neighborhood. Black folk came on their own business.
Rapping Billy Joe came down while we were talking with a neighbor, an apparent show of intimidation, which ended with him kicking her cute little dog.
Awesome.
Hey,
I don't like dogs. I'm allergic to dogs.
Well, we don't like squatters, but you're still here.
I don't like dogs.
Detroit police have been called out here at least seven times over the past few months, including to issue that citation for squatting. First offense is a misdemeanor, but even with the new laws, getting them kicked out can be difficult simply because there's not a clear homeowner here. And without the homeowner to complain and to go to court, well, sometimes this is what happens. They end up staying, and the hardworking neighbors paying the taxes, they have to live with it. For now, we're live on the city's east side. Back to you.
Yeah, certainly a tough situation. End up staying and tearing up that house, so it can't be sold. So hopefully the police can get them out eventually.
So will reparations help? And house hijacking, called housejacking, which is the original premise of this podcast. That's why I call this my house. This podcast grew out of a housejacking incident that I experienced. Housejacking or house hijacking And I think Michigan is the only state in the union that has laws on the books to counteract house hijacking. But house hijacking in Detroit is rampant and has been rampant for, I'd say, 30 years, at least 30 years. I've had, matter of fact, Heidi Peterson. She had a house in Detroit. She went somewhere for a while and came back home, and it was somebody living in their house. She called the police. Police didn't put them out. Should Detroiters, black Detroiters, receive reparations? Okay, that one is a political piece, but apparently I didn't put that in there. In any event, so I don't get it. It seems like reparations can take place and can be formed in many different ways, but Coleman Young was mayor for 20 years. Detroit has had black police chiefs. They've had a few black mayors. They have had majority black city council members. See, I'm looking at all these as forms of reparations. God knows how many department heads that run the government in Detroit. Very successful CEOs. I've named a few, and there's a whole lot more. Don Barton. I don't know if Don's still living. Don Barton, casino, riverboat casino millionaire. Detroit. Mel Farr, the late Mel Farr, black millionaire, Detroit, used cars. Countless. So, once again, if those Detroiters can make it, including Berry Gordy and Smokey Robinson, Smokey's still around. Berry Gordy's still around. Let's face it, Motown, if you had to name one of the black-owned companies in the United States thus far that have taken a person who was middle class and or poor, or taken a black teenager and made them into millionaires, Motown had to be in your top three to five companies, if not number one or two. I think it might be, not, you know, because, you know, there's Philadelphia Records, Solar Records, then you got, you know, the whole hip-hop thing, and then you have some other industries. But Motown's a high-profile example. It's easy for me to spout out names that a lot of people would know. And they were founded and operated many years in Detroit. The Winans family, not part of Motown, but, you know, they have a well-attended church in Detroit. And the Winans recording group, you know, the BB and CC Winans, not doing bad financially. So do you cut them a reparations check? See, I can't see where any of the people that I've just named, 100% of them black, 100% of them from Detroit or lived in Detroit, all became wealthy and or rich. Reverend C.L. Franklin, Aretha Franklin's father. I mean, he's passed over. But should the city of Detroit cut his estate a check, a reparations check? One politician in Detroit, and I thought I uploaded her a clip, but apparently I didn't, says that it's not a handout. It's a hand up. I'm just trying. How can it? I'm looking at, you know what? Look at what all the people that I name, 100% of them black. If you reparations can also take the take form in the form of opportunity, but you got to be proactive. Coleman Young. He received, this is my interpretation, he received his reparations in the form of being allowed to run for office, which he did. He became mayor, and he was mayor for 20 years. That was reparations to him and those who supported him. Berry Gordy, who was a factory worker in Detroit, decided, you know what, I want to start my own business. He had a record store that didn't, I think that flopped. But then he went to his family, and they loaned him some money. He didn't go to a bank now. He didn't get a – there was no government program. His family helped him start Motown financially, and look what he did with it. Once he started Motown, look – I've named several artists already. Some became wealthy. Some became rich. You know, some have horror stories too, though. But there are more positive stories coming out of Motown than does Motown or any artist that came through Motown deserve a reparation check? Have you ever heard Berry Gordy ask for reparations? Have you ever heard Berry Gordy ask for any type of a handout or any entitlement program? Ask Smokey Robinson. His career, the success of his career, did it depend on any type of government entitlement program? Stevie Wonder, who some say would have a disability because he's blind, should he get a reparations check? In the case of Detroit, what they're doing, now, it's not a law there. They're just in the very, very early stages of this in Detroit. But essentially, I look at it, here's some politicians that, by marketing the idea of reparations, because with all those success stories, and there was no slavery in Detroit. So they can't base it, whatever they come up with in Detroit, they can't base it on slavery. And I don't even see how they can base it on discrimination. As a metric, look how many people left Mississippi, Alabama, and Arkansas and moved to Detroit and prospered. Black folk. I got a cousin. He's no longer with us, but his wife and, you know, children still are, grandkids. He grew up in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And he had a wife and small child. And people, this is, I guess, part of the Great Migration era. Probably the second Great Migration, something like that. But in any event, you know, he had friends that would come from up north, you know, from Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana. They would come back home to Pine Bluff And, you know, they would be driving a nice car, had nice clothes, had the trinkets on, you know, spending a little money. You know, they come for a little short visit. There was a lot of that. You know, people from up north who are originally from the south, once again, Mississippi. Hell, if you look at the original, the origins of the Temptations, most like, what's his name, Eddie Kendricks, I think he was from Alabama. A lot of Motowners, the heyday, the golden age of Motown, a lot of those people originated from the south. Illinois also, like the Staples singer, Pop Staples, was from, I think, some small town in Mississippi. They moved up to Chicago. So anyway, getting back to my cousin. So my cousin was married with a small child, and what he did was, in Pleasant Stevens' experience, because Pleasant Stevens is from Arkansas too, my cousin originally went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, looking for a job, because we had other family members who had migrated to Milwaukee, and, you know, they were doing all right. And we're not talking about small families, but the whole family was doing all right financially, living in a nice neighborhood, didn't have to worry about no racism or nothing like that, got, you know, decent jobs, many of which were out graduating high school, mind you. So he went up to, originally he went up to, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but didn't have any luck there. Okay. So then, but he was sustained by, we had an aunt in her family, so he didn't have to worry about money. But then he went to Detroit, and when he went to Detroit, he quickly got a job. And he applied for a bunch of them. He got one real quick. Oh, it was, this dude used to pick cotton people when he was in Arkansas. But anyway, but while he was on that first job, he got a call from a second job, Ford Motor Company. But he didn't want to stand the dude up he didn't want to drop the dude that hired him, like, out the gate. So, you know, he gave ample notice to give the guy enough time to get somebody new and train up somebody new until he, because at one time he was working General Motors plus this other job. And he was living in a nice neighborhood. I stayed with him for about a month once. And a nice neighborhood in a nice part, west side of Detroit. But his last job at Ford Motor, he was a test driver. And I believe he did not even finish high school. So there were a lot of stories like my cousins. Pleasant Stevens, who's been on here several times, and, well, I'm going to call Pleasant up today so we can get him on tomorrow. Or Thursday, because we got a guest tomorrow. Pleasant did the same thing. He had a family. He went to Chicago, got a job, stayed in a room, got things together, then sent for his family. All these, and we're talking about people, black folks from the 50s came to Detroit, found success. 60s found, like I say, even now in 2021, in July, you can go to Detroit, Michigan, and you can buy a house for as little as $5,000. Now, I might need some work, but it's a $5,000 house. There's an abundance of $20,000 to $40,000 houses in Detroit. So I'm just asking a question again. It seems like, you know, with all this, all these success stories coming out of Detroit, that there would be no need for black folks getting reparations in Detroit. I don't get it. If Berry Gordy can make it. Now, not everybody's going to be a millionaire. I get that. But my cousin wasn't. But he, once again, he had a nice job at General Motors. Many black folk do. You know, you got the big three, you got other companies. Detroit is rich in successful black entrepreneurs up there. Now, not all is Shangri-La, because we did play one clip of the Detroit public school system is in shambles. But my point is also that black folks, and I'm using as a metric, I'm going back to 1960. Black folks have had Detroit on lock since at least 1960, if not earlier. What are reparations? Now, officially, there's no reparations yet in Detroit. Once again, it's in the very early stages of their, you know, they politically, they had to do a study. And so it might be some years before this happens. But apparently since Evanston, Illinois, has got something on the books, and what do you call it, Asheville, North Carolina. And I said this back when I found out about Evanston, Illinois. You're going to have local politicians in, I guess, majority of cities with a black population or a significant black population. They're going to be using the reparations platform in order to get elected or reelected. So far we've got Evanston, Illinois. We've got Asheville, North Carolina, which it's in discussions. Now we have Detroit, Michigan, and I suspect somewhere along the line that you'll probably have Chicago in there, Indianapolis in there, Cleveland in there, possibly Baltimore in there. And those reparation talks will have, they'll have nothing rooted in slavery. And that's where the reparations talk started, and people have been talking about it for years, based on slavery. So it looks like since the critical mass of the reparations people weren't getting any traction with slavery reparations, they shifted it to the local level, and those reparations talks are not rooted in, none of those discussions are rooted in slavery. Now, another form of reparations, Juneteenth, I would call that another form of reparations. That is now a federal holiday in the United States. So we've got Martin Luther King's birthday, federal holiday. We have Juneteenth, federal holiday. We have Black History Month, which is, it's not a law or anything, but people know it's February. We've had a black president of the United States, black first family, and now we have a black vice president of the United States, graduate of Howard University. I would say all those are examples of reparations. Kamala Harris, she's not from Detroit or anything, but black woman VP. In any event, if you got a response to, should Berry Gordy and Smokey Robinson or Diana Ross or Tito and Jermaine Jackson or LaToya Jackson or Janet Jackson or Stevie Wonder or any of the Motown acts from the golden age of Motown that is still alive, should any of those Detroiters, if Detroit had the signatory capacity and a bank account to cut a reparations check right now in 2021, should any of those people that I just named who are millionaires or wealthy, not all of them are millionaires, but some are wealthy. Should they get reparations checks? Should the children of Michael Jackson, Prince, what's his oldest son? He's got two sons and a daughter. And like Blanket's the youngest. I forgot the name of his two older kids. Prince Michael, and then I forgot the girl's name. But should Michael Jackson's three children, and he left behind a sizable estate that they're living off of right now, should Michael Jackson's three children get reparations? Should Marvin Gaye's children get reparations from Detroit? They're not cutting checks, I'm just saying. But if it ever gets through and becomes a reality in Detroit, all the people I've named have connections to Detroit. Oh, you know what? Hold it. You know, we got to back up. Take away the Jacksons. Their roots are from Gary, Indiana. All right, so the kids of Michael Jackson and all the Jacksons, no. If Gary, Indiana ever has a reparations thing, all right, we'll include them back in the reparations department. We're just talking about Detroit-based Motowners. So we take out the Jacksons because that's a Gary, Indiana thing, different state. But you know what? Let's throw in the three daughters of Florence Ballard. Florence Ballard, the late Florence Ballard, was the original. She was the founder of the Supremes. Originally, it was four of them. So she left behind. She died in her like early 30s. Should her three daughters be cut a reparations check from Detroit, if it goes that far? And she's got grandchildren now, Florence. Should those grandchildren get a reparations check? And they're not rich now. The children of Florence Ballard, her three daughters, Florence didn't leave any significant wealth behind. But she was a native Detroiter. But you know what? I don't know what the rules are. Like I say, it's in the very early stages of what's going on in Detroit. I guess they got to do whatever they do to make it an official study first. And then after they come up with the study, then I guess they'll have conference or committee meetings, infinitum, on that. And, it's a process. And, you know, it might be 3 or 4 years down the road at the minimum that something might happen. In Evanston, I think they came down to some home improvement type stuff. I had to read back up on it. But in any event, here's another thing. And 619-768-2945, you guys differ. With all the positions that of power and wealth and access that black folks have had in Detroit for all these years, It's 2021 right now. And like I said, I'm using a metric of 1960. That's 61 years. And they've had power more than that, but we're just going to, longer than that, but I'm going to just put it at 61. Black Detroit, black folks have had a lockdown for power, economics, and the legal system, the political system, for at least 61 years. The last 61, well, they've had like one white mayor, but still, he was outflanked by majority black city council. But in the past 61 years, Coleman Young alone had 20 of those 61 years. Okay. So with black folks holding, I mean, for the last, I can't see where anybody, who would be disadvantaged? The majority of your police were black. Still are in Detroit. Black police chiefs in Detroit. Black female police chiefs. I really can't see Detroit as where there was any type of systematic racism. I can't see it. Not in Detroit. Not for the past 61 years. I can't see it. If you can, call and let me know. They've run the courts. They've run the local government. You've had a number of black folks that were wealthy that helped bankroll various parts of the system up that way. Anyway, I don't see it. But that's just me. I lived in Detroit for about a year. And one of the reasons why I was up there is it was, to me, it was like the land of milk and honey. Inexpensive living. You can buy a house, like I say, you can buy a house in Detroit right now today for $5,000. Granted, the majority of these $5,000 houses, you're going to have to put some money into it to get it fixed up. But you would be surprised at the amount of homes, houses in Detroit that you can pick up for $5,000-$10,000 that really don't need much work. A lot of them just need, you know, cut the grass and do some paint jobs and maybe replace a window pane or two, and you're good to go. That's not the case with all of them. But there's some gems like that up there that you can find on a weekly basis, maybe not a daily basis, but definitely a weekly basis. So, like I say, I can't see where you can even use the word discriminated against. I look at Detroit as the land of milk and honey, of one of the lands of milk and honey. In any event, okay, we're not getting any takers on this today, so I'll leave it at that. We're going to revisit this again as they move forward. We're going to see what they do with this when the study comes out on should Detroit get reparations. Because this is something that the city council, this is their project. This is their project. And let's see how that comes out. In any event, we'll be back tomorrow with a guest. Everyone have a good rest of the day.